And welcome to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
Oren, you know what? It's getting cold around here now.
Is this fall. What we're reduced to, Bob? We're reduced to discussing the weather? We know that's a death knell for any podcast.
Well, you know, I'm just saying it's getting cold again. It's nice for me to be able to say cold again, right? Because a year ago, we were able to say it's just cold, right? Yep. Last year, because we started this podcast in the middle of summer, right? It was like June. We started this podcast last year, right? So
I had that weird, introspective moment when you told me how much, I think this was back in October, you told me, about how much space all of our collective episodes used up, and it was something like 4.6 gigabytes. And I was like, "Is that it? It's a year of podcasting?
That's it. That's it. What more do you want?
I don't know.
I don't know, man. It's a lot of podcasts, like 100 megs each, man. I don't know what you're...
This is just my misunderstanding of how much space a podcast takes up.
The hard drive. Can you do it well? But anyway, speaking of anniversary type events, Trek Mate's actually going to be doing their 1 year on the 21st of this year, or this month, excuse me, November 21st. They've got 1 year going on.
Yeah, don't we have an email about that, don't we?
We do, actually. I'm going to go ahead and read it out here. It's from Maress.
It's
from Maress on behalf of Colin, if I'm actually reading this correctly.
No, I think she just likes to use his catchphrase.
Oh, okay.
This is all Maress.
Okay, that works for me. All right, so, hello everyone. TrekMate is coming upon their 1 year anniversary. This is a great achievement for any podcast, but for TrekMate especially so, in view of the incredible journey it has been on since its inception. What began as a single show has now blossomed into an entire network of podcasts, games, videos, feature articles, and so much more. Two of the highlights were the groundbreaking 24-hour charity podathon in September, which we were a part of, all things Trek.
Yes, we were.
And we talked about stuff. And, of course, Star Trek London, where TrekMate delivered top-notch coverage, as well as hosting debates and getting to meet the stars in person. And on a very personal note, the founder and co-host, Wayne Emery's second daughter, arrived just 10 days ago. And yes, she's so cute, she would make even Spock smile.
Well, Spock smiles at blue plants, okay? Sometimes we don't know.
That's true. That's a fair point. Please give these guys a great big shout-out and send your greetings to TrekMate at TrekMateFamily.com by November 21st at latest if you'd like them to be presented in their anniversary show. And, of course, come visit our website at www.TrekMateFamily.com and see all the wonderful things they've done. Have a great day. Live long and podcast, and that's the part I think we're supposed to be from Colin. But anyway, got that from Maress. So thank you, Maress, for letting us know. And, I salute you, TrekMate. Congrats on your 1 year. And having the network you have now of all that great stuff you guys got.
They really impressed me. They have, I think, 8 podcasts going on right now. It's not all the same people, obviously. They have a fair amount of overlap. But it's a lot of podcasting going on one website. And they have a whole bunch of very interesting stuff. Right now, I think I listen to, I listen to 10 Forward and The Wilderness. 10 Forward is kind of a, I don't just call it a Star Trek variety show. They have a lot of different stuff they talk about. So I guess it's more like our show than anything else. They don't have like a specific set of episodes that they follow or anything. They just have topics that they discuss. And then The Wilderness is a Deep Space Nine review show, which is definitely not safe for work. It's very colorful. But
Well, you still pack boxes, right? Sort of, kind of. Yeah. Well, you're doing quality control right now.
Sort of. But yeah.
You have headphones in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have headphones in, so you don't have that problem, really. Whereas I work in a, multi-billion dollar investment firm where I would not be able to listen to something like that. I don't have the luxury of having headphones.
I am the 99%, Bob.
It's a sordid life we live at the top, Oren. It's a sordid life.
Yeah, Maress actually was kind enough to nominate us for the I think it was People's Choice and Entertainment Awards on the yearly podcastawards.com. However, due to my misunderstanding of how this works, we're not on the voting list, because what it is, as far as I can understand it, it's a little confusing. If you get enough people to nominate you, then you can go on the list for voting. So we only had one nomination because I was like, all right, well, we've been nominated. That's good. So we aren't on the voting list.
But that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense. A lot of different submission entries are that way for that. So that makes sense. I'm not too heartbroken about that.
It's not like it doesn't affect our show. It's just something that if I had known about it, I would have probably flogged it a little harder just around.
We need a marketing PR department.
We needed a department. The problem is we don't have departments at all.
Expansion, Oren. We need expansion plans. We have big things to accomplish in this world. Big things to do. Big plans.
I am going to be... I am recording another Tales from the DMZ episode today, so there's that.
Really?
Yeah. Although,
There we go.
Yeah, one thing that I will ask for any of our listeners who feel like helping us out just a little bit, we would love, or at least I would love, I don't know about Bob, but I would love more iTunes reviews. Because right now we have 3 5-star reviews with very short text descriptions, and it looks fake. Like, if you have a show with just a bunch of 5-star reviews, it doesn't look like they're actually, it looks like they just put those up themselves, which I don't think we did. Bob, did you do that?
I have not done anything of the sort. But what I can do, though, is I can go ahead and make my account and log on to it and give us a 1-star review if you want me to balance it out for you. Thing.
Anyway, I would love our listeners to leave us iTunes reviews. And you don't have to give, don't feel pressured to give us 5-star reviews. Give us what you think we deserve. So there's that.
Rate it like a Foundry mission where we have no idea what the scale is.
Well, for me, just my own personal scale, a 5 would be something that you would always make time to listen to. 4 would be great. You listen to it when you can. 3 is, is decent. And 2 is needs work. And 1 is you would not listen to this. That's how I usually do my ratings. It really kind of weirds me out.
That's fair.
So say what, Bob?
That's fair.
Yeah. When I listen to podcasts that review episodes, they always have like a 1 to 10 rating, but they always seem like they have a phobia of giving anything a low review, like a low score. So they never give anything below a 5, and even the bad ones that they didn't like. And it's like, well, that really just means you're rating it on a 1 to 5. And so if you're going to give it a rating, you have to give us a clear distinction of what a 1 is and what a 10 is. So we have some kind of context. Like, for me, if I was rating Deep Space Nine episodes, In the Pale Moonlight would be a 10, and Let He Use Without Sin would be a 1. And that's where I would put my... That's how I would judge episodes, that sort of thing. But if everything is a 5 or higher, it's like, well, what's the point?
1 through 5 is just fail immediately anyway.
Yeah.
Why would you bother? Star Trek Renegades.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to mention that again, because they're coming up on the end of their Kickstarter, and I think they're at 123,000 out of their 200,000 goal, so they can do it. And I've chipped in a little bit, and I'm hoping they make it, because the show looks interesting. And the more I hear about it, the more I think it would be pretty cool. So, I would recommend people to head over to Star Trek Renegade.
What's the thesis of this thing again? What's the selling point of it?
The premise of the show is that
Tuvok, there we go.
So yes, is that Tuvok is now the head of Section 31, and he is working in some capacity.
Really?
Yeah, that's the premise. And that he is working in some capacity with Admiral Chekov to, protect the Federation against some kind of threat, and it involves the creation of this new ship, which looks, as you've described it, like the Defiant was trying to swallow a bird of prey. Because it's got the bird of prey neck, and it's got the Defiant kind of back-end-looking thing. It's some kind of elite strike team, I would assume. Beyond that, there are not a whole lot of details. In one description I read, they mentioned that Tuvok is the head of a newly reorganized Section 31, which I think I would not be surprised at all if the explanation on that is that after Sloan died, Section 31 suffered a series of problems, because Sloan, we were never entirely clear how Section 31 is organized, but we know that it's like Sloan was really important. So if Sloan was like really high up in the organization, his loss might have been a very crippling blow to them. I don't know.
I always kind of thought, I mean, I haven't looked or read at a lot of like soft can at all. I'm sure there's a lot of soft can material to draw from for Section 31.
Is there ever? Keep going.
But the impression I got from watching the Section 31 episodes that we saw was that Section 31 was a very insulated organization where you had, you know, cells operating essentially independent of each other for various little things and taking care of interests wherever they might be. Like one cell might be over in Romulan space and their cells hanging out somewhere in Klingon space, another one in Cardassian space, and so on and so forth. You know, with all these cells, No one knows who the other cell is or anything like that to help keep Section 31, that secret organization that it is.
Yeah, to an extent, but like by the same token, Section 31 has to have at least a fair degree of organization because Section 31 is like as a super secret intelligence organization has very clear and defined goals. It's not like say the Bajoran Resistance where their goal is to hurt Cardassians. You know, they have to have a very clear objective. And that would require a greater degree of organization and a greater degree of interconnectivity than, say, a bunch of independent cells. Because, you know, they could all be working, but what are they working towards? What are they trying to do? And if Section 31, you know, we saw the way Section 31 carries out its operations in, Inter Armas Silent Legacy. That clearly took a lot of coordination to pull off. With discrediting the Romulan senator, I don't remember her name, but I know she was a recurring character, and bringing the head of the Tal Shiar into power and doing all that stuff. That was clearly not something that they just came up with, you know, at the last minute. So I could see Section 31 suffering some serious setbacks, especially if they decide to go with some of the various soft canon stuff that's floating out there. One thing that really amazed me is that looking into the soft canon, there are so many background characters that end up being Section 31 agents. It's like you know the tactical officer from First Contact, the guy who Worf replaces. That guy was apparently a Section 31 agent in some book. And it's like,
okay.
Sure, why not? So I'm not really, as I think anyone knows, I'm not hugely attached to the Star Trek books. But I could see that working. And, you know, I think Tuvok, if I was going to pick someone from canon characters that we have available to be in Section 31, I think Tuvok would be pretty high up on the list. Because, obviously he's a security officer, but he has, on a couple of occasions in Voyager when they were actually paying any attention to him, he did do a few things for, like, you know, the greater good that would probably be frowned on by Starfleet. This particularly in, I think it's
Janeway.
Well, yeah. What's the episode? I think is it Prime Factors? The one where they go to the planet that has that, like, that jump technology that could theoretically get them home, but they don't want to trade for it. And, like, Tuvok and Torres and Seska get together to try to, you know, to do a backroom deal.
Oh, I don't remember what the name of the episode is.
Prime Factors, but maybe I'm wrong. And Tuvok's explanation to Janeway once they get caught is that he's like, this was a decision, this was something that you had to do, but you couldn't do it because of your position as captain, so I did it for you. That's a very Section 31 attitude. So I could totally see Tuvok being involved in Section 31, depending on how far this is after Voyager, and it said somewhere. For him to be the head of Section 31 is a little bit of a surprise. It makes me think he would have had to have some kind of Section 31 leanings before, you know, he joined. Because I imagine one does not simply walk into the head of Section 31. You probably have to have some kind of, you know, there's some kind of, if not vetting process, at least certain people have to agree that you're in charge.
Suddenly the conspiracy episode of 7 of 9 doesn't look all that bad in comparison when I hear you talk about that, when you say that.
Yeah. Well, the thing about that episode was that they raised the question of why Voyager had these, what were they called? Cobalt devices. And like, why did they have those? And he just doesn't say. Tuvok just doesn't explain it. And it's like, why did you have those, Tuvok? I wouldn't have brought that question up if you weren't prepared to answer it. Because seriously, those things would have been real useful, like, later. Since, you know, apparently they are like torpedoes on steroids.
Yep. So awesome.
But anyway, that was a bit of a tangent from our Star Trek Renegades discussion, because I want to see them succeed. because, you know, who knows how long it'll be before we get another Star Trek television show that's, you know, endorsed by CBS, if we ever get one. This one looks pretty good. I like Walter Koenig a lot. I like Tim Russ, and I think that they could make, I think they can make it work.
I don't know. I think I'd have to research a little more first, and I'll probably do that once we're done here. Check out Star Trek Renegades a little bit more. It's just, every time I see that graphic of the Defiant of Prey, I just kind of cringe a little bit. So it's like, ah, my God, why the Defiant of Prey? I don't understand.
Just looking at it, the big reason I decided to fund them was because, obviously, we don't know a whole lot about the show. We only have their basic, you know, elevator pitch to go on. And so it could be a lot of things, and it could end up being something I don't really care for. But this is the same team that made Of Gods and Men, which was a pretty solid fan production, mainly, I think, limited by a budgetary issues. So if they actually had a real budget to work with, say $200,000 that they maybe got through Kickstarter, then I feel like they would be in a slightly better place. That's why.
No question. Yeah, I can dig that. Mm-hmm. So is there a new poll on StarTrek.com I don't know about?
You know, I put that in the show notes before I actually looked, because, well, StarTrek.com does a weekly poll, and I kind of like checking them out, but this one's really boring. This one is it's what would you do to prepare for the Kobayashi Maru test, and it only has three options, and they're kind of lame. It's like, hold on, it's a study and try your best, don't prepare, it's a no win, and cheat. And it's like, really, only two of those are actually options. I mean, unless you're really lazy.
Here's kind of the thing about the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a sentiment I've kind of started to develop in the past few years regarding the Kobayashi Maru, is that the idea of the Kobayashi Maru is that it's supposed to be a no-win scenario. And the whole thing about a no-win scenario is that you're supposed to, as it was echoed in the latest Star Trek movie, the idea is to experience fear.
What?
Right, the idea to experience fear.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Are we?
You know, like
I thought we had agreed at a previous podcast that was ridiculous.
To experience fear.
Well, yeah. We had this. Maybe. I guess this is one of the ones you weren't here for. We had this discussion, and we sort of. I think it was like me and Ari and Lillian were all here, and we were talking about it, and I think we basically came to the conclusion that the idea that you can experience fear in a simulation is somewhat goofy, because you know it's not real. And I don't know. Anyway, but you finish your thought. I interrupted you.
Well, right. I mean, going into it, obviously you're going to know that I'm in a simulated bridge, and, you know, this isn't real. You know, that's true. But, you know, when playing, like, you know, for instance, when I play video games or so, and there's very tense situations, and, you know, like, for instance, when I actually played the game called Fear, for instance, there was a lot of shock moments and stuff where you go like, oh my God, or when you're watching like a scary movie, you know the movie's not real, obviously. It's just, it's on the screen.
Right.
But if something jumps out at you, or if there's like some kind of psychological terror going on of some sort, you know, that can cause a physiological reaction.
Right.
You know, for you as a person. You know, your adrenaline will surge, or, you know, the hair on your neck will stand up, things like that. And those are moments that can occur within a simulated environment, right? Now, the problem with the Kobayashi Maru is that shock value is kind of gone, because it's been around for, how long has the Kobayashi Maru been a simulation for Starfleet Academy? I mean, hundreds of years now at this point, right?
an awful long time.
A very long time. So every cadet that's at least going into a command-type position, at the very least, is going to be familiar with the Kobayashi Maru, and even then, I have to believe that there is a YouTube-like thing in the future. There has to be, where people can see the Kobayashi Maru be played, right? Be played out by other cadets and such. So if everyone knows already what the Kobayashi Maru is and what the end result is going to be for it, it's lost its value at that point as a valid kind of simulation for that effect, for that kind of shock value effect, for that effect of you're going to go into a situation and there may not be a solution for it. I feel that particular simulation should be different and be a different name every year.
Right.
For cadets. You know, like, the curriculum should change every year for simulations and such. Maybe that's a lot of work, I don't know, but I really think that the Kobayashi Maru is kind of a bit of a misnomer at this point, you know, for it. You know, it should really be something else.
Well, one thing that I considered is that, and this could work within the established canon, is that perhaps the Kobayashi Maru isn't a test you go into knowing you're going to take, usually. Like you show up for a simulation and then it just happened, and then they like, you know, they slip into Kobayashi Maru, and obviously they would have to change the specifics because the moment you hear the word Kobayashi Maru, you're like, oh, okay. And that would make sense to me. But even then, the idea of experiencing fear is still, I can't really accept it, because you can experience fear watching a movie or playing a video game. That's true. But those mediums, those are artistic pieces that are designed to work, to basically fool your brain into thinking you're in danger. Or that something else, something that you care about, mainly the characters, is in danger. And they are specifically designed that way, and there are a lot of, you know, visual choices and audio choices and, you know, all of these things that go into making it scary for you. But the Kobayashi Maru simulations that we've seen, especially the one in the new movie where they made the claim that you were supposed to experience fear, didn't have any of those things. It was a dry, simulated experience. And the only reason you'd be scared, it's like being on a starship bridge. And the only reason you would be scared while you're on a starship bridge and fighting someone is if you are actually in danger. Because you, like, even though all around you it seems like a perfectly calm bridge, you know that if the Klingons blow you up, then you're going to die. And in a simulation, you're going to know that's not going to happen, and there's none of the artistic elements that would make you, that would fool your brain into being scared anyway. So I can't accept that explanation. They have to do a lot better than what they did.
The difference between that particular simulation and playing a video game, though, is that with the video game, I'm a civilian, and I don't have any of the training procedure and thus trained outcome for particular actions that they would. You know, we see this a lot in today's military as well, where people will drill on things, and there'd be simulated environments that they go through, and they, in fact, make efforts to improve this kind of stuff through, like gimbal technology, you know, things like that, in order to make the environment more real, mm-hmm. Is what it is. But, you know, I understand what you're saying with that. It is presented in a very dry manner. I understand that part of it, but what's supposed to make it real is all this training you've now gone through to deal with this situation that it has come up. You know, but yeah, what I'm saying and suggesting, though, is that the Kobayashi Maru needs to not be the Kobayashi Maru anymore. It's that it needs to be, you know, as iconic as it is, it really needs to be a different set of circumstances every year, so that it is new and different, and I can't go to YouTube and go, oh, this is what I can expect, and then, you know, just get through it.
Right. And they should do is, I think, because I've always felt the purpose of the Kobayashi Maru was more to see how a commanding officer reacted to a steadily, a steadily increasingly difficult set of circumstances. What I think they should
things are going from bad to worse. What do you do?
Constantly, they really need to not tell you that you're taking the no-win test. They need to ideally make you think it's a very important test, and then just keep telling having the computer keep making things not go the way you wanted them to go. And because if you're the captain of this training ship and you think your final grade, you know, rests on this scenario, and it keeps going wrong, you at that point will be under real stress, and you will actually,
yeah, there you go.
That will actually show the instructors something of how you would react in an actual command situation, because you have a personal stake suddenly. And then if you react well, they know that they can, that you, or at least they have some indication that you can be trusted with command. So I think that, like, that's always what I assumed the Kobayashi Maru was for. Like, Savick didn't seem to know she was taking the Kobayashi Maru in Star Trek II. Like, afterwards she tells Kirk there was no way to win. And obviously she's a Vulcan, so she doesn't go, like, freak out about it. But the implication I always took from that line was that she didn't know that this was the no-win scenario.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you don't think she would have brought that up to Kirk afterwards, because Kirk would have been like, yes, it was. You know, like, if you randomly, you know, like, we are in the dining room. And it's like, well, yeah, we are. We all know that. Why did you say that?
Again, this is something I've just started to kind of realize about the Kobayashi Maru, and thinking more about, you know, how that kind of develops and what would be a better way of implementing that is in fact kind of, as we're talking about here, is to be you know, different, have a set of circumstances, or something where what you're talking about is have the computer make sure things are going the way opposite of what the cadets want to have happen, so that it is actually more of a test and actual stress is involved and such. So,
yeah, and I'd also like to think that they sometimes do the Kobayashi Maru test outside the simulator. One of the only good things that ever came out of the first season of Next Generation was, do you remember that test? Like, it was like the stress test that like Wesley had to go through when he was applying for the academy.
Oh, yeah.
It basically did that. That makes a lot of sense to me as a surprise, like, you know, you think it's a real situation. And I imagine that the Kobayashi Maru would sometimes have to be, you know, administered that way. And not just always as you're in the command seat. Because not every cadet in Starfleet is on the command track. So, you know, how do we test how science officers respond to the no-win scenario? Or security, or people who are on the security track.
These zygotes are not propagating in a way that you anticipated. Oh, what do you do?
Yes, that's exactly what I meant.
I don't know. I was just trying to figure out what a science officer would get stressed over.
Look, it's tachyons, okay? The science officer gets stressed over tachyons.
The tachyons are not colliding properly with the neutrons from the star. What do you do?
Whoa. Well, obviously you set up an anti-proton field. Those guys do anything.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. That's right. I forgot my trek for a second.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's...
My makeup foo wasn't strong that time.
But, I mean, yeah, that's basically all I had. I was a little disappointed with this week's poll on StarTrek.com just because it seemed kind of simplistic. And also, apparently, recently, in the last poll they did, Voyager was voted as having the best music. And I was like, what? But best of both worlds, guys. Come on. How do you not remember that?
Was it theme music? I mean, was there anything specific about it?
No, it was just show music. It wasn't opening. Like, you know, sure, people want to give Voyager the best opening credit sequence. I can't really super disagree with that. But Voyager's music I always thought was really boring and, like, kind of bland. I don't know. Compared to the stuff Ron Jones did for The Next Generation, I always thought it was just not up to snuff.
Yeah. True. So you have something to talk about photographing people.
Yeah, this was something that, and you can tell how on top of things I am today, because I keep zoning out, and Bob's like, Oren, we have a show note, show note. but, okay, so this is, I'm not going to name any names here, because I don't want anyone to feel like I'm targeting them, but I was one of the podcasts that I listened to recently, the people on it had gone to a convention, and they had met someone who was in costume, and they had apparently, and they were bragging about how they had taken some pictures of that person without asking their permission. And I was just, I was listening, I was like, really, guys? And I know that's a problem that we sometimes get with conventions, especially when, you know, you have people who come in costume, especially if they are dressed as, like, you know, sexy aliens. People want to take pictures of them, and they don't always wait to ask permission. And I'm just like, guys, that's not the kind of behavior we should be promoting. That degrades everybody. And it's really easy to just imagine yourself doing something that you just don't want a picture of. And that's there. You have instant empathy. And I just, it strikes a personal connection with me because I'm very particular about photographs of me. I am really unphotogenic. And I have asked people on a couple of occasions not to put pictures of me online because I don't like the way they look. And I would be kind of upset if they just, you know, snap some shots of me and put them online. We're like, hey, look at Oren, look at these things he did. Or even if they didn't put them online, even if they just had them, I wouldn't be happy with it. And it's just, you know, I was very surprised that they were so gung-ho about it.
Hmm.
Do you think we should talk about Disney buying Star Wars? Everyone else is talking about it.
I don't know what really to say, I suppose, about Disney buying Star Wars. You know, it's okay, a business deal went down. Lucas decided to sell his stuff, even though he said that there wasn't going to be episode 7, 8, and 9. Now they are making a season 7, 8, and 9. But I don't know how much creative control he's got, if any. I think he sold all the rights. I don't know. I haven't really looked into it a whole lot. But, you know, I remember the day it was announced, and I remember reading the article and this stuff, and I was going, oh okay. I guess is the thing. That's cool. I mean, it's Star Wars is kind of a different beast.
Yeah.
With that, it's supposed to be...
Just a little.
Well, the Star Wars is supposed to be about, like, the hero's journey, and that's very much a set beginning and an end, right? You know, once the hero's completed his journey, that's it, right? We're done. We're done with it, right? You know, it was a good story. You know, the whole Star Wars arc, you know, at least 4, 5, and 6, 1, 2, and 3, obviously, you know, there's a lot of, you know, contention on whether or not they were good or not. I feel that they're probably for a different generation of folks than myself, perhaps, to enjoy for their various reasons. But the whole thing at least has a, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end to it, right? And I have to wonder, what is 7, 8, and 9 going to be about? You know, it's like I don't really care at this point, you know, what happens to all these characters, you know, at the end of Episode 6, Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, Luke has balanced out the Force, you know, or I think anyway, he's like the only Jedi around as far as we know, you know, or maybe not. There's this whole expanded universe thing that I don't know if it's canon or not for Star Wars out there.
As I understand it, they're not going to use any of that, which I can't say I blame them. The extended universe is like big and convoluted, and if you try to use part of it, you might end up like confusing people even more, because there's no way you could make all of it in your movie, and people would be like, wait, so this part is canon, but this part isn't? That would just be messy. So I understand them not wanting to use the extended universe.
So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, like, I just kind of shrug at it, Disney buying Star Wars, you know? I know Disney has been doing things with Star Wars and having kind of Star Wars-themed stuff in their parks for a while. You know, I know there were like this dance thing that's on YouTube you can go see, which is, I mean, it's it's always fun to see a stormtrooper doing the pelvic thrust, as a gif. I mean, I don't really have strong feelings one way or the other. I guess if I had to put my foot down somewhere, I'd say that I'd prefer they didn't, because the way I understand the whole thing was originally imagined to be a hero's journey, type story. And the hero's journey has already been played out. You know, we're done with the hero's journey now at this point for Star Wars. You know,
right.
It's like, why do we need to tack on more about this? Like, why do we care? I don't care what Luke Skywalker has done. He's vanquished the evil Darth Vader and all this stuff, you know, at this point.
Now the natural conclusion to that would be the hero's fall and then the rise of another hero, but that aside, because I have no idea what they're actually going to do for the movie, and frankly, I don't really care at this point. I'll probably go see it, but I don't have a huge amount invested in it. The reason why I brought it up, why I thought it was funny, was that after the news broke, I lost track of the number of articles and like social network posts, because, you know, referring to Facebook and Twitter, and even podcasts, where people kept saying over and over again, calm down, nerds, this isn't the end of the world, everything will be okay. And everyone was pointing out, look, Disney owns Avengers, and that was great, don't worry, it won't automatically be terrible. And I was like, wait a minute, who is saying that? And because I couldn't find anyone whose response to this was, no, my childhood! Like, everyone who I saw, the worst reaction I got from it was ooh, I don't know, Disney is known for making bad sequels. And that was from me. I was the one who said that. That was the worst reaction to it I'd seen. People seemed, you know, either ambivalent, vaguely hopeful, or at least had the attitude of, well, it can't get worse. So, I was very confused where all this reaction telling people to calm down was coming from. Where are these people who are upset that we need to tell to calm down? Somebody direct me to them so I can tell them to calm down, please.
I've seen some scattered stuff on, like, Reddit, reddit.com, saying, you know, oh my god, Star Wars is going to be so much worse now with the Disney all over. It's like, okay.
And I guess I don't
respond to any of it. And I mean, there's other people who just say, you know, calm down. You know, like, this, it can't get any worse. More or less the same stuff you've been seeing is what I've been seeing as well.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
most of
scour across the net. And I think that's pretty much the sentiment, is just like, well, you know, like, whatever. We'll see what, you know, maybe they'll come out with season 7, it'll be the best thing ever. It'll be better than the original 3. I highly doubt it, but it's possible. I mean, we don't know yet. It's supposed to be 2015, right? That's supposed to be a thing. Yeah, so.
Yeah, Michael Ardent is writing it. The same guy who wrote Little Miss Sunshine and the Phineas and Ferb movie, and there was another one. Oh, Toy Story 3. That was the other big one. And so he's pretty talented, and apparently he also just wrote he wrote a movie that's in post-production right now called Oblivion, which is a big sci-fi action thriller, so I suppose that will be a nice watermark to see how well he writes sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Right, I gotcha.
I only brought that up because I thought it was amusing. I suppose we should probably get to our actual topic at some point today.
I suppose. That's the thing we can do, I guess. We have to. What are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about parenting in Star Trek.
Oh, man. Yeah. Worf, best parent.
Yep, and I accidentally did some research for this. I hadn't planned to, but then I had some time to kill this morning while I was making food, I put on some episodes of Deep Space Nine, and I inadvertently got to the episode where Sisko and Jake go sailing in a spaceship made of wood. And I don't know, I've had an episode, at least one, where I complained about the spaceship made of wood. And that ship is still goofy, and the fact that they they talk about it like it works like a sailing ship, and they extend the sail by turning cranks, and it's just kind of like, really? Is this a spaceship? There's a certain level of, like, a certain base level of sophistication you need to be a spaceship. It almost
but
got...
But it's the wood from the Jumjaw tree, or in the Jumjaw tree.
It almost got to the... And, you know, and looking at it now, I actually, after rewatching that episode, I don't think the implication was that the ship is made entirely out of wood. Sisko just mentioned that he was getting a shipment of lumber from somewhere, and that he was going to be cutting it with a saw. So maybe he was just making some chairs, I don't know. But I was just watching it, and I was just looking at it, and I'm like, alright guys, so the spaceship has a certain level of sophistication you need, and it was kind of goofy and kind of made me think of the Flintstones and the way they used dinosaurs to replace everything. Like, I half expected them to, like, stick their feet out on the bottom from the bottom of the spaceship and just run along. You know, Flintstones car style. Or have, like, because, you know, in Flintstones, the way they change the channel is they have, like, a little tube with a dinosaur in it that flies out and presses the button and then comes back. It kind of reminded me of that. It was just a little bit, even if this is a primitive spaceship, it would still need to have a certain amount of computer circuitry to navigate, and you wouldn't extend solar sails with cranks.
Well, you had that celestial sextant.
Right, which I think you would be really hard-pressed to maneuver in space with that. Maneuvering in space is a lot of math. There's a lot of math involved, and I have a really hard time believing that Sisko was doing all that in his head. He wasn't even, like, writing it down. Like, when Apollo 13's computer went out and they had to do all their math by hand, that was really serious business. You know, they had, like, pages and pages of math notes that they checked with the people in Houston to make sure they were doing it all correctly. Because, you know, this is the kind of ship that if you mess up, you can't just turn around and try it again. It's not like driving a car. It requires a lot of very precise mathematics. And that's the kind of ship they were flying. So it was sort of... But that's not about what the parenting... Okay, that's a side thing entirely.
It is.
No, we're talking about the spaceship made out of wood.
But the Jumjaw tree.
The Jumjaw tree. Well, you know. One thing that... But then something that episode did have that I liked... I actually liked the B-plot of the episode a lot with Bashir and his doctor from the from his class... That didn't know him. I thought that was...
Oh, yes, on the Lexington.
Yeah, on the Lexington. Which, I think at some point we should, like, make a timeline map of the various places they say different ships are, because I'm pretty sure the Lexington has come up a couple of times in places it couldn't all possibly have been at the same time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I liked that B-plot, but I also liked the plot between Sisko and Jake. Like, spaceship made out of wood aside, I think that's a good... you know, father-son episode. And I've been hearing from a lot of people that Sisko's not a good father, and I was looking at it like, no, I think he does all right. I mean, it's sort of one of those things where, you know, Jake gets into a little bit of trouble, but overall, not too much. I mean, if anything, I would think that if Sisko failed as a parent in any regard, it was that he failed to instill a real work ethic in Jake. And that's the sort of thing where a parent can only do so much in that regard. Like, you know, parents are not mind control devices. They can't force their children to grow up a certain way. And, like, just looking at the Deep Space Nine episodes, I mean, Sisko is there for Jake. He makes time for him. They have dinner together as a family whenever they can. And he provides a fairly good role model. I think overall he does, you know, he does a... The only problem that Sisko has as a parent, I think, really, is that he's kind of racist. And he almost ends up instilling that in Jake when he gets all mad at Jake for having a Ferengi friend. But he does come around on that eventually. So, overall, I would actually hold Sisko up as a pretty good example of parenting in Star Trek.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so, too. I never got the sense that he never... Or he always had a sense of family values about him.
Mm-hmm.
He never not had that going for him. You know, he'd cook dinner for crying out loud
all the time.
And you know, unlike my dad, it would not be spaghetti, you know, mm-hmm. all the time. You know, it would actually be. I mean, this is also because of the fact that he was also a chef and had, you know, culinary skills that were beyond you know top ramen. You know, so just to have the sit down dinner and stuff, and then talking about what's going on. A lot of that, I think, has to do with. I mean, you speak of like work ethic, for instance, and instilling work ethic, and you know, in your child and such. I don't think that's very much something that comes from also economic interest, right?
Right.
And as
right.
we know, in Star Trek, the Federation's economy is very, very different from what we have. It's a very alien thing, actually, to us. What the Federation's economy is being a post scarcity. Right. Economy,
mm-hmm.
essentially, right? So, you know, being that, you know, everyone within the Federation citizens, for the most part anyway, at least, you know, at least on Earth. So let me go ahead and qualify that. At least people on Earth, and those that are human, have the opportunity to go ahead and pursue whatever they would like to on their own initiative because all their basic needs are taken care of anyway.
Right.
Right? So that probably plays into it. A little bit, and then also just the way their culture is. Like, I don't. Whenever we see Earth being portrayed, we don't see a lot of video arcades, you know, around or anything like that. And that's not at all to say that, you know, that's a bad thing or a good thing. That's not a judgment in any regard about that. But it very much seems to me like Earth is a very cultured place, and there's a lot right. to do with the upkeep of that culture and then expanding on that culture. So it seems like everyone's job. On Earth, if you're a civilian, is that of being an artist in some way. That or you're being very directly involved in some sort of mathematical engineering of some sort, you know, electrical, mechanical, civil, something like that. You know, it's a very civic-driven, you know, community or a very artistic-driven one. And you kind of fall into one of those two, from what I gather anyway, for being on Earth in the 24th century.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So as far as a work ethic goes... I think Jake is motivated for his writing, but the thing is the way with the way that the economic interests are structured, he can do it on his own at his own pace, and he becomes a successful writer.
He does
in the future. You know, like he's offered a position at this Pennington School. You know, and in fact, in that same episode, he's mulling that over, going to New Zealand or not. If he really wants to leave for this school for an extended amount of time,
I think. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
What I meant with that, and I've talked about this before with the character of Jake, is that you see, Jake basically becomes an adult when at about the same time the Dominion take over the station. And, you know, both age-wise and emotionally. He grows up, and of course, that's about when he turns 18. So he, you know, at that point, he's not really a child anymore. And during the Dominion takeover of the station, he's really busy, right? He is writing articles, no one's seeing any of them because Weyoun's blocking them, but you know, that's not his fault. He's talking with everybody on the station, he's taking part in the resistance of all things, and he is being very productive. But after the Dominion leave the station, you get a number of episodes where Jake is kind of just lazing around. And he doesn't seem all that interested in doing anything, particularly the episode where Nog comes back and is, like, you know, hanging out with Jake and being roomies. And it feels like Jake is a character who has... he can work well...
Are you talking about after It's Only a Paper Moon, or are you talking about when he's a cadet still?
when he's still a cadet still.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There are. It seems like he is a character who can work well under pressure, under deadlines, but he doesn't really set his own deadlines. When he doesn't have someone telling him he needs to do something, he's just kind of like, you know, I'll get to it whenever. And that's I can sympathize with that. I work better under deadlines than I do trying to set my own. So I can understand that philosophy. But I imagine that, I always imagined that on Earth, if you went to a school in the Federation, on one of the core worlds, there would be much more about teaching you to be self-motivated. And that would be a focus of the curriculum, is because, as you pointed out, there's no economic incentive. You don't have to go out and work for a living because you won't starve and you still have a house. So there still needs, but we also, from what we've seen of Earth, it isn't full of a bunch of people sitting in holodecks all day. So there clearly has to be some kind of motivation to get people to go out and do something useful or productive. And by productive, I don't necessarily mean build a bridge. Art is productive too, definitely. And, what's Benjamin Sisko's dad's name? Admiral
Cartwright.
Yeah. Admiral Cartwright. He has a restaurant. And, clearly Earth doesn't need his restaurant. It's not like anyone's going to starve without his restaurant, but he is contributing to the culture of Earth by having that restaurant.
Right. That goes back to, most people seem to have a cultural job of some sort, or they have a very civic, minded job of some sort. Like I was saying, like engineering of some sort. That seems to be kind of the two, self-motivated interests that people have.
Right.
I literally like that idea of grade school, for instance, being a lot about self-motivation. That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I assume it would.
I wonder if there's any material out there right now, actually, regarding, school like that, mm-hmm. like elementary school and middle school, high school for the Federation. That'd be an interesting thing, actually, to get into.
Well, on a completely real-world note, that's sort of the premise that there's a school on Vashon called the Harvard School, which my girlfriend Lillian went to for a couple of years, and they have a similar idea. There is a lot of self-motivated projects that kids do there. It works to, more or less, depending on the student. But it's a neat idea. But my original thing about Jake was that because Jake didn't grow up in the Federation primarily, he grew up on Deep Space Nine, which doesn't have Federation school. It has, Keiko O'Brien teaching a school. Keiko, who has never taught before. And he's surrounded by Bajoran kids whose families all have to pay rent. And because Bajor still has a currency-based economic system, and he's, of course, his best friend is Nog, who's a Ferengi, so he is not in a situation where he would receive that kind of early self-motivated, based schooling, and then he grows up and suddenly doesn't have to, pay for anything, or his needs will always be met, and he doesn't have that motivation, which to me is why he seems kind of lazy in the episode where he and Nog are roomies.
That's something I've never thought about before. Exactly what educational credentials does Jake have?
He seems to have passed basic high school. Is what I'm getting from him. He eventually, I think, did decide to go to Pennington. I think is part of his story, but it's basically not until the end of Deep Space Nine, as I understand it, and that's all soft canon, really. We know that in soft canon, he eventually became like a super serious reporter, author, journalist guy, and sort of a similar thing happened in The Visitor, where we got to see future Jake. But that's all supposition. We don't know for sure what he would have done at the end of the episode. At the end of What You Leave Behind.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is a bit of a tangent onto the topic of Jake. Shall we take a music break? Come back and talk about more parents?
More parents. All the parents after this music break right here on TrekRadio.net with All Things Trek.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of All Things Trek. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturday 1 to 3 Pacific Time on Trek Radio.
And welcome back to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Warren.
Oh man, so I want to plug this real quick because yeah. I think it's pretty rad. This website you just showed me, goodoldgames.com.
Yeah, you do. You plug that.
Consider it plugged. That game is the game. That website looks actually pretty cool. It's got some of the old Ultima games on there, and I'm actually pretty pleased to find that I can get Neverwinter Nights Diamond Edition for like $10.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm pleased to see that it's a thing I can do.
No, Good Old Games is amazing. I've been playing it for a while. I've been getting games from it for a while. Right now I'm slogging my way through Icewind Dale, which is a really long game. And it's got, it's got all the old Black Isle games. It has a bunch of old stuff. It doesn't have Star Trek Bridge Commander yet, which I was disappointed by, but hopefully it'll get it eventually.
Does it have any Star Trek games?
It's got a few. I think it has the original Armada.
Really?
I'm not positive about that, but it's really nice because there are a lot of these games are just really hard to come by as a hard copy, and they have. What? Now we know you smiled in the chat room. I don't know. What is that in reference to?
Oh, and Garrus, they had a smiley face in the thing, but it was a misspell to somebody.
Okay.
Galactrix is calling them out that we now know that they have smiled.
That's fair. But what I meant was, what I was saying was that they're just really cool because they distribute their games without any kind of DRM, which is just, it just makes them so much easier to play. And they're reasonably priced, I think. Like, I got Icewind Dale and both expansions for $10, which I don't think is a... I do not think is an unreasonable price to ask. So, yeah. I would definitely recommend Good Old Games if you are looking for a good game that is old. That is my my advice to you, sir.
The advice. Take it good. So, there's more parental stuff going on, right?
Yeah, we've got more stuff to talk about than just Jake and Sisko. I actually skipped ahead to Jake and Sisko just because I had been watching those episodes earlier today, and I haven't actually watched a whole lot of Star Trek recently, so it felt kind of nice. I'm mainly going to be skipping TOS because there isn't really a whole lot of parenting in TOS. The only two instances of children I can even recall off the top of my head are Miri and I think it's So the Children Will Lead. Is the one, because Miri is the one where they go to the planet where the kids are, like, immortal and are super creepy and weird, and it's...
What about Journey to Babel?
What is that about? What's that one about?
Oh, man, Journey to Babel is where we actually see Spock's father, otherwise known as Romulan Commander.
Right! Sarek! I completely forgot about Sarek.
We get to see him, also known as Romulan Commander, from the really scrub Romulan ship.
That ship was awesome. You shut your face.
Scrub Romulan ship set on suicide mission.
That's not canon. I'm not I don't accept your explanation, sir.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, that was kind of an example, I thought, of, while Spock was a grown man, and, you know, he was a commander in Starfleet and the first officer of the Enterprise, you know, it very much still displayed, you know, there was still some contention a little bit, you know, after Spock's upbringing between him and his father.
Right, right. Well, okay, hang on, Bob. I'll see your Sarek reference in TOS and raise you an animated series. Let's talk about, since we're going to be talking about Vulcans, we can talk about the, I don't even remember the name of that animated series.
You want to talk about things that aren't canon, we can talk about the animated series, I suppose.
Now, this one is, according to Roddenberry, this one was canon.
Okay.
Because it established a bunch of really important stuff about Spock's past. It's the one where they end up going through the Guardian of Forever again, and accidentally messing up Spock's ancestry, so Spock has to go back and fix it. And that's where we get the on-screen example of Spock being an outcast among other Vulcans, because he's half-human, and all that jazz. So and that episode was interesting because we saw basically that first of all, Vulcan kids don't wear a lot of clothes. That was kind of weird.
Okay.
Well, that's the thing. If you've seen that episode, right?
I have not. I can't say I have sat down and watched much of the animated series. I think I've seen about one or two episodes of it. I've seen Bem. I've seen that one. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, part of another one I might have seen, I think, which it had Robert April in it, I think.
Huh. I don't know that one.
Those are the two I've seen of the animated series. I don't really care to see much more of the animated series because, you know, life support belts are a thing.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like the animated series is something you have to watch, but it's, you know, it was interesting because it showed us the sort of the start of Spock's relationship with his father. And there's clearly that. Then that was a contention that even continued into the Next Generation, with unification. And it was like it was interesting because we got to see how the Vulcans start off and how they learn their emotional suppression techniques, and how Spock, you know, had problems learning it because of his human side, and but at the same time is like it seems like Spock is, despite having problems, is actually more successful, because both in that animated series episode and then again in the JJ universe, we see that the Vulcan kids are a bunch of jerks. They're just really rude. I mean, because you've seen obviously you've seen the Abrams film, that scene where Spock and the Vulcan kids have a confrontation is pretty much directly lifted from the animated series episode, except in the animated series episode, no one calls Spock's mom a whore, and there's no fist fighting. You know, it just they tease him about, you know, being not about being emotional while they are being extremely emotional, and they're like,
rude, very rude.
Yeah, but it's interesting to see the how Vulcan children are raised, and like Spock's relationship to his father is definitely a very complicated one. That was actually one of my favorite things about the new movie, was I thought that they did Sarek very well. But other than and again, even in that episode, the episode is more about Spock's relationship to himself, really, because you know, present Spock goes back in time to save past Spock from dying, and present Spock talks a little bit with Sarek, and you know they get a little bit of a connection, but it's mainly about present Spock sort of teaching young Spock how to be a good Vulcan. It's kind of what's going on in that episode.
Okay, then. What really ultimately made Spock's upbringing probably, you know, difficult was the fact that he's half human. He's not full blood Vulcan. You know, his mother's right. human, his father's Vulcan, right? And it very much seemed to me like Amanda, who is, you know, Spock's mother, had taken to the Vulcan way of life, or had, you know, given herself into that, you know, or at least tried to follow and respect that, you know, of Sarek's wishes, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the impression I got. Now, Spock is kind of a unwilling participant in that aspect of it, right? Because he's only a child.
Yes.
Right? So now he now has to you know, fight not only his Vulcan passions, but now he's got this extra human element that he has to contend with while he's being, you know, brought up in a Vulcan way by his father. You know, so it's kind of a double whammy, I feel, for Spock, and I feel for him. You know, obviously he's a really stellar and, you know, kick-ass individual, you know, as is when he's all grown up and such, but, you know, it's very obvious that particular contention is still there, because of his upbringing, and that kind of, I feel, comes around in during Babel in the original series when, you know, they're standing there with Sarek and Spock, and it comes out a little bit more when this particular scene in the engineering room where Kirk is giving a tour for Sarek and Amanda, and he asks Spock to come over and ask Spock if he could go ahead and explain the computer circuitry or some such to Sarek, and Sarek's like, I taught him this, dude.
I know things about computers.
You know, it's just kind of like this, I think a bit of a parental arrogance, I feel, that kind of came with that, more so than just a Vulcan arrogance, if you will, mm-hmm. with that, with yep. regard to that. But it's really nice to kind of see them come together a little bit at the end of the episode, which has to be at the expense of the mother of all things.
Say what now? I can't remember that episode. You're going to have to explain. Remind me what happened.
Well, he has a heart. Sarek has a heart condition of some sort, he has some sort of problem where McCoy has to do an operation on him, and the only way he can do an operation is if he has blood. Now, the Enterprise doesn't have a lot of Vulcan blood on hand, unfortunately, so they decide to
That's bad
do
news
a transfusion.
For Spock.
Right, exactly. So they decide to, you know, that's we can use Spock. But the amount of blood that they would need would be so much that Spock would die, so they decided to give Spock this drug that accelerates his blood production capabilities and such. But that's kind of has a monkey wrench thrown in because there's an assassination attempt on Kirk because the Orion Syndicate is involved with trying to sabotage the talks that are going to be going on at Corridon and all this stuff. So, I mean, all that was going on. But at the end of it, finally, with all the actions that had transpired, you know, because of the assassination attempt on Kirk, Spock then therefore had to take command, and his mother had an argument with him. It's like, well, you have a duty to your father to actually supply this blood and such because he's your father, and Spock's like, well, no, I can't do that. I got to command the starship, and she counters with, well, hey, anybody can command the starship under normal circumstances, and Spock's like, well, these aren't normal circumstances. Arr! You know, he's very duty bound and such.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kirk makes this. He puts on a show of faking his injury isn't that bad and takes command again so Spock can leave. But anyway, finally, once all that's been resolved, what's that?
I just said Kirk does the wackiest things.
He does do the wackiest things. His fighting technique among them. But anyway, once the operation's all done and over, Spock and Sarek are there with Amanda and Kirk and Bones and all that stuff, and Amanda turns to Sarek and says, aren't you going to thank your son? And Sarek's like, for what? He acted in the only way that was logical to him. And Spock is like agreeing with him. I was like, this was the logical thing to do. And Amanda's like, God, you two. Gosh darn it. So frustrating. Vulcans. Yeah. So frustrating.
Which, I mean, I don't know. It's always, from what I remember that episode, the thing that really, I remember thinking was, why is Amanda with this Vulcan man? What's going on with that? But that aside, we actually saw in the new movie that Spock apparently, in that movie he talks about how that he did have a choice. He could have chosen to, you know, live the human way, or he could have, you know, but he decided to follow the Vulcan tradition. So, which, you know, from the way they were portrayed in that movie, I kind of have to wonder why he did that, but I suppose it made sense to him at the time.
Well, the movie's got all sorts of different things going on for us, so
just a little bit. But that is a very interesting, you know, example of parenting in the Star Trek universe, and I can't believe I forgot it. Thank you, Bob.
Well, there we go. I'm here to back you up. So the next section I see we have here is alien species and their parenting.
Yeah, I was just discussing. I was just looking at the way that, like, the sort of the general approaches that each of the species take to parenting, because it's like with the Klingons, you have a very unusual family structure, which is sort of the whole family is kind of treated almost as one unit under the law, because it's like Worf described it was that a Klingon is responsible for the acts of his family and they are responsible for his,
right?
And so it's family bound, but at the same time, it's obviously not universally that way, because obviously Worf and his brother are bound together very closely, but we also see, like, the Duras family, and, I mean, you know, you can make whatever judgment about them being sort of mustache-twirlingly evil, but you notice that the Lursa and Bator don't show up at any point when, you know, Duras is fighting for the chancellorship. They only show up after he's dead. And they both immediately abandon Tyrall, Duras' son, when things are going against them. They kind of leave him behind as a peace offering.
True. Very true. I think that really has more to do with Klingons beating their chest a lot about, you know, tradition rather than it does with, you know, practical circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because, I mean, if you go back to, like, the days of Kalis, right, where, you know, all jokes aside about Space Kalis and, you know, his space adventures, in case anybody forgot about that little discussion we had about Space Kalis.
Yeah, we're talking about, this is a line reference, right?
No, I think we were talking about maybe. Was it Podcast UGC or us? I could have sworn it was us, and we were talking about the Klingon Society and the Herc and all this stuff. I think it was when we had David on a while back. And I know one of the things that came out of that is that there was potential for Kalis to have space adventures after he left because spaceships were apparently maybe a thing when Kalos was around, but I'm pretty sure that's not the case. In fact, I'm positive that it's the case where there were no spaceships when Kalos around. But anyway, I think it had more so to do with at that time because of just the way society was, because of the technology it had, you very much had smaller knit communities, and therefore your family units were, you know, much closer together. You didn't have, like, the son and the father, you know, separated by big, long distances or so, like you would in the 24th century, right? Where, you know, for instance, Martok was, you know, off at war, and his son was, like, somewhere else, right? I mean, at the beginning, even though I think Martok was a changeling at that point, we had, in the Way of the Warrior, Martok and his son Drex were very much in the same battle fleet, you know, but they
weren't on this... No one likes to talk about Martok and Drex, okay? Drex is, as far as I can tell, Drex was just removed from the face of the universe after that episode. Because we never heard from him again.
Right. So, like, well, they seemed to be serving like the same battle fleet, maybe not necessarily the same ship. There are plenty of other Klingons there where I'm sure like their parents weren't there or their children weren't there. You know, they may have been back at home, or they were serving maybe somewhere else within the Empire if they're part of the military. You know, it's. That whole idea, you know, it's just that it's just a tradition that they've just clung to for so long, and it hasn't evolved with the times.
Right.
Right.
And one thing that I noticed about Klingon parenting styles, from what I can see, is that on the one hand, Klingons are all about, you know, the family bond, and they always identify themselves as Worf, son of Moog, or daughter of, or, you know, it's always, they identify themselves by their parent. But Klingons also seem like, and I don't know if there's a canon example of this, but they seem very self-reliant heavy. They seem to, like, there's this idea, I think, among Klingons that you sort of, like, the child is either going to be strong or he'll die, is kind of the idea. And I think we saw a little bit of that in the way Worf tried to parent Alexander. Worf was constantly frustrated that Alexander didn't take to the stuff on his own. And he was like, I don't understand. Why do I have to convince you to go have Batleth fighting sessions? Why don't you just want to do that?
So it's just really funny. Why do I have to convince you to have Batleth fighting sessions? Anyway, I guess if you want to jump into Worf here really quick.
Well,
Worf is a whole different beast, I feel, when it comes to parenting.
Well, so the Worf-Alexander thing, we've talked about this before. I don't really think that they thought that one through when they introduced it, because they introduced it and then they just sort of didn't do anything with it. It was like, the only episode, like, Worf, he sent Alexander to live with his parents a couple times, and when Alexander was around, he was just constantly irritated with him. That was, like, their thing. And it just... Worf was just a very lazy and not very committed parent. Which, I guess, could be realistic if, you know, if some woman suddenly dropped by and said, oh, by the way, you have this kid. Oh, I'm dead. Now you have to take care of this kid. I could see maybe that you weren't ready to be a parent, and I could see someone reacting like that. But
oh, yeah, Worf absolutely was not ready to be a parent. Absolutely. That is absolutely the case. It was very evident with the way he tried to do a lot of things with Alexander, and especially when Alexander first came back, you know, after Reunion, I think it was Reunion,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, where Kalar gets killed. I think that episode's called Reunion.
Yeah, that sounds correct.
I'm just going to call it Reunion, no, if someone wants to correct me.
Isn't Reunion the Klingon Civil War episode?
No, that's Redemption.
Okay, well, then probably. It sounds like that's probably Reunion. Continue.
Right, so Worf's assumption. Yes, so Worf sends Alexander away. Then Alexander comes back, having spent this, I think, maybe a year or two with his grandparents, or with Worf's, you know, foster parents or so, or adoptive parents, and... Worf very much, his style of parenting is kind of more like programming is what he's trying to do. But if I just put these values into place, if, you know, X equals one, and if I tell you, you know, X, you're going to think one. You know, that's what he's thinking, you know, here, or what he's expecting out of his style here with Alexander. You know, but that's not what he's getting out of Alexander. And, you know, Troy is trying to counsel him a little bit in this episode, you know, with, like, you know, it's not as easy as just telling him a story of Kalis and sending him on his way, Worf. You gotta actually, like, you know, be there and, you know, counsel him more and more. Like, it's an ongoing process, is what he's saying with what Troy's saying to Worf in this regard, is that you have to, you know, you have to work at it. You gotta be, you know, a parent. You can't just set the parameters and then expect everything to go the way you want it to. It doesn't work that way.
Right. And I'm not against the idea of having a story about Worf as an unprepared parent. Like, that, you know, to me that's interesting. The reason why that storyline has always bothered me is that Worf just didn't seem very committed. And, like, the way Worf throws himself into everything else that he does, I expected him to have a little bit more, you know, stick-to-itness. And just, you know, and to really make it his a priority, whereas he seemed to just want the easiest solution possible. You know, he was just like, "Counselor, how do I make this child leave me alone?" was what I expected him to say.
One thing that Worf will strive for, it's efficiency in all things, and
I suppose that's true.
I mean, it's pretty obvious the way he carries out his duties on the Enterprise. You know, before he went to DS9, obviously, on the Enterprise, he was always trying to improve things somehow, some way. And typically that involved working with a computer or a set of values, right? A set of, you know, variables that he could, you know, manipulate mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that is very set. Something he can move around and manipulate pretty much at will and then know immediately what the outcome is going to be. Because that's the tool set he was familiar with. You know, suddenly he's thrown into, you know, this having to be a parent thing, and he's trying to force his understanding of how to make things more efficient and smooth with having, you know, his own job duties into trying to be a parent is what it is, which is what makes him, I think, a really bad parent. He's not being flexible and adaptive to that particular situation. You know, he hasn't loosened up enough in order to be a parent in that regard.
And it makes matters worse is that Alexander is definitely a problem child. Like, We see Alexander is, when we first see him, there are a couple of episodes where they actually explain that he's a habitual liar. Like, he lies about things for no reason. And he's a bully even, I think, when Worf's parents bring him back to Worf, they're just, you know, it is not a shining recommendation of this kid. And it's,
nope.
Obviously this is something that Worf wasn't ready for. And that's the difficulty of dealing with a child in that situation and trying to help them not be that anymore is something that I can't even fathom. Like, as someone who has a hard time just interacting with children, because I'm never exactly sure how to act around them, the idea of trying to, you know, turn a kid's life around in that situation, frankly, the idea scares me.
So what you're saying is I need to trap you in an elevator with three children, and you have to figure out a way to escape with them.
Bob, that doesn't sound credible at all. That wouldn't even be the episode, like a plot for a science fiction episode or anything. You hush your face.
Wait, Disaster TNG? What?
What? Excuse me? It's an episode, by the way. One of the only episodes where they ever did anything with the fact that the Enterprise has kids on it. But I think my main problem with the Worf-Alexander storyline is the way it turned out, which was basically that Worf just said, "All right, I give up," and he just sent Alexander away again. And then we saw Alexander come back once in Deep Space Nine, technically twice, I suppose. He was in another episode for all of, like, 30 seconds. And he shows up in Deep Space Nine, and he is just... He clearly did not grow up well. I mean, he's, like... And it was just kind of like, I'm just looking at him, I'm just like, oh, come on. I did not like that outcome, is kind of what it came down to. I did not like the referendum that gave on Worf. And I just think, even if Worf was not prepared, I think he just would have stuck with it. I think he would have kept going, you know, kept banging his head against that proverbial wall until he either accomplished something or, you know, blew himself out an airlock. I just, from what I know of Worf, it just seems like that's what he would have done. But, I mean, who knows?
one of the things, because to talk about, again, to switch gears back to how different species treat their kids, we were just talking about how Klingons have kind of a, you know, there's an expectance that Klingons will be self-reliant. I think the Cardassians are the other really interesting family dynamic species that we have, because we don't really know a whole lot about how the Romulans raise their kids, other than that. We have that one throwaway line from the Romulan at Galornden Kor, where he tells Geordi that apparently Romulans with birth defects are killed. I was like, oh, really? Huh. But I didn't see any other episodes about Romulans didn't really suggest that that would be a thing. But with the Cardassians, they have Cardassians have a very close-knit family unit. They make a big point of that. They have huge families. Like, Gul Dukat has 7 kids, 8 if you count Zial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like his family's not abnormally large by any indication. They just have lots of kids. And they make a big deal about how the families will very often all live together in the same house. You have, like, three... There's the Cardassian Legate at one point who describes it as, like, 3 or 4 generations all eating at the same table. And one thing that I noticed, which is a very stark contrast to at least the way that we do it mostly here in America, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but I know that among most people that I know, there's this idea that the parent can tell the child how things are and give them an introduction to the world, but it's then up to the child to eventually make up their mind about what they think and, you know, the way they think things are. Whereas in Cardassian society, it seems like the expectation is that pretty much all the time, the parent is expected to pass on their values to the child. And the child is not expected to come up with their own values, they are expected to get them from their parents. And we saw that, I think, particularly with the way that Dukat treated Zial, and the way Dukat just completely flipped his gourd when it turned out that Zial did not have the same values that he did. And there was also...
You'll have to refresh my memory on that instance exactly.
Well, when they're on the station, you know, the Dominion have captured the station, and Zial is working with the Resistance and trying to convince Dukat to be lenient with Rom after Rom was captured trying to sabotage the weapons array, I think it was. Maybe it was the deflector dish, but he was sabotaging something.
I remember he was really concerned about her having a part in that, or potentially something to do with that, after she had come and asked for, you know, amnesty for Rom. I remember that part of it, but I don't recall ever an instance necessarily where she was the target of any ire or disappointment on Dukat's part. I mean, I remember Dukat would very much interact with the things around her. Like, a good example would be when Zial and Garrick are both kind of having a bit of a relationship. He is all over Garrick and like, what are you doing with my daughter? And all that. But he doesn't really, I mean, he may have some cautionary words for Zial. Like, you know, he's a shady character, Zial. You know, I wouldn't want you to, you know, get hurt or anything like that. And she's like, oh, Dad. And it just kind of gets dropped at that point, and she carries on with Garrick, you know. But
right,
I don't recall her ever being the target of anything like that.
I actually was naming the wrong episode. It's the one you were talking about, where Dukat finds out that she and Garrick are hanging out together. That, if you recall, that's the episode where it's revealed that Cardassia is allied with the Dominion, and they have this plan to blow up the Bajoran sun and, like, wipe out, well, Bajor, obviously, but also, you know, the combined Federation Klingon-Romulan fleet that showed up because they think, you know, a rumble is about to go down.
Right.
Dukat knew about that plan. And Dukat tried to take Zial with him. And then Zial is like, she's talking about him, and she's talking to them, and she is trying to explain that she's built a life here. She doesn't want to leave. And he, you know, he's like, all right, well, then you're dead to me. He doesn't directly say that to her, but that's his reaction. And then later on, there's a sequence between them. And again, I think this is during when the Dominion is taken over the station, where he says to her, these people are our enemies. And she says, they're not my enemies. And, you know, granted, I could see this whole thing playing out between two humans. It's not like it's only a Cardassian thing. But just from the way Cardassians describe their family units, and also from, Chain of Command, where the Gul Madred brings in his daughter and is talking and is talking to her, and sort of early on, there's always this impression that they are, that the, you know, Cardassian children are early on impressed with this idea that they need to be loyal to the state, and they're supposed to get that from their parents, and that, you know, it's, there's like family loyalty is very important in Cardassian society. There's not, and I think that feeds into their whole idea of loyalty to the state. They aren't really all about, you know, free thinking. That's sort of not a huge value in traditional Cardassian society.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where I got that from. That seems interesting.
Okay.
But
yeah, I'll have to rewatch that. I didn't recall that Dekat was in the planet. I mean, it makes sense that he was in on that plan.
They clued us in that he was a little bit later, when the Dominion is on the station and he and Zial are, you know, have kind of made up and are being a family, Kira is like, Zial, he left you here to die. And Zial's like, well, he admits he overreacted. And it's like, overreaction there, sir. You shame yourself.
Yeah, just a bit.
I mean, usually if I stub my toe and then I get mad and, like, throw my Cheerios on the ground, that's an overreaction. But, you know, Zial has rose-colored lenses for her father. That's just a thing.
No kidding.
Yeah. But if we were going to talk more about specific characters, there's, like, one of the first, in TNG, we have a couple of different, parental relationships other than Worf and Alexander. And the first one we get is Beverly and Wesley. And, you know, obviously Wesley's not the world's most popular Star Trek character, but that the relationship that they had, I always thought was sort of indicative of the way that Gene Roddenberry thought people would be more emotionally mature in the future. Do you remember the episode where the plot is that this woman dies on an away mission and her son is left an orphan on the Enterprise?
The bonding, I think, right? And Worf feels responsible and such, or Worf is responsible.
Well, part of that episode's production is that Gene Roddenberry supposedly told the writers that in the future people don't grieve. They see death as a natural part of life. And obviously that's not true in Star Trek. That wasn't true in the original series, and it doesn't hold true in the next generation. But that was an idea that Dean had, or Dean, blah, that Gene had. Dean Roddenberry. it was this idea that Gene Roddenberry had, and that influenced, I think, the way he tried to portray the children on the Enterprise as being much more emotionally mature than they should be for that age. And I think that might have been something that might have figured into why we hardly ever see Beverly acting in a maternal role to Wesley. Like, it just doesn't come up that often. Like, they don't spend nearly as much time together as Jake and Sisko do. Granted, Wesley's older at the start of the series. You know, mm-hmm. But they don't seem to interact all that much. Like, honestly, if I watched the show and I didn't know that they were mother and child, like if I just tuned into some random episode, I wouldn't figure it out. I don't think until someone directly told me, I would not guess that they were related in that way. They seem like friends. Granted, you know, he calls her mom, but he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't seem to go to her a whole lot when he has problems. He usually goes more to, like, Geordi or Picard. And there's a couple episodes where they really have, like, a parent-child, like, relationship, but it just seems like, as part of, and we all, I think most people know that Gene Roddenberry was very fond of the character Wesley, but it seems like because he wanted children in the future to be more emotionally mature, we didn't get a whole lot of parenting in that relationship. That's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah. That's a really interesting idea, though, is that people don't grieve in the 24th century. That seems a little odd to me, because
yeah,
one thing that makes us human is with our emotions is that they have peaks and valleys. You know, we can we can go from being, you know, extraordinarily happy and ecstatic to, you know, the depths of grief and anger. You know, even, you know, it's like we have this spectrum. And it seems really odd to me that it almost gets to the idea of having kind of an autocratic, you know, controlled society to me. it seems, which doesn't jive at all with the idea of what we have with, like, the Federation at all. So it's a little weird, I think, to hear that. And that's kind of what Gene's idea is. I mean, I kind of have an idea where he's going with it, with the whole emotional maturity of it. And, you know, death being a part of, you know, just life. Like, I understand that, but it seems odd to have the idea that grief needs to be thrown out the window because we accept the fact that death is a thing that occurs. It's like, well, no. It's like, I accept the fact that people die, but I'm not happy about it. I'm certainly, you know, sad that's a thing that happens.
Yeah. So, well, the whole idea that Gene had sometime between creating TOS and TNG was, I think, this idea that in the future, humans would have emotions, but they wouldn't have any of the negative effect of emotions. Like, so we wouldn't have the problem of, you know, sometimes our emotions make us react in ways that are not beneficial to us. Like, we get real mad because we find out our girlfriend is cheating on us, and we go and, like, start a fight with the guy we think she's cheating with. And, like, that's not productive. That doesn't actually help us accomplish anything, but it's something we do because of our emotions. And I think he had this idea that just wouldn't happen in the future, which is very strange because it happened all the time on TOS. It was a big part of the drama. So again, you know, we've talked about this before. I don't really know where he came up with that concept. But it did make it very difficult for the early writers of TNG to make anything interesting happen. And that's part of the reason why in the bonding, the kid just comes off as kind of, I don't know, robotic almost, because he...
flat.
Like, yeah, he's not sad. He's just kind of... if I had to guess, I'd say the actor, like the young actor, was trying to play him as numb. Is kind of the way it looks to me.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Enough, this is also actually involves Worf in that he and Worf bond.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the kid and Worf, because they're both technically orphans. So it's interesting because Worf is actually taking on a bit of that kind of, you know, fatherly role a little bit with that kid in that regard.
And of course, we never see that kid again. So, you know,
nope, never again.
Loses a little bit of that impact. One group, because we're almost out of time, but I wanted to talk about Keiko and Miles briefly.
Yes.
Because they are actually married. They are a couple raising kids, whereas most of the other parents we see on Star Trek are single parents, or they are parents of adult children. So, but mm-hmm. we have Keiko and Miles, who have two kids, both Molly and Kiriyoshi, and I only just noticed the way that name is spelled, that it's spelled K-I-R-A, and it's like, oh, for Kira, I get it. Okay, makes sense now. I didn't get it
really?
Before. I just didn't
really?
Notice. I didn't notice
Welcome
it.
Welcome to the party. Welcome to the party 14 years later, Oren.
I know, right? But those two are, as much as I don't like Keiko, and I don't think she's a very good character, as a couple, those two are very interesting, and I like them because their children are a part of them, and, like, help define them as characters, but they aren't obsessive about it. It's not, like, every episode about Miles isn't about his relationship to his kids. And, in fact, the one episode that really stresses that relationship, which is the one, I don't remember what it's called, but it's the one where Molly falls through a time vortex and comes back all feral.
I think it might be called Timeless.
Timeless, yeah.
I think.
That episode kind of has some problems, I think, almost. And it, like, Miles and Keiko's family, I think, works better in the background. Because I would, without a doubt, say that Miles is the best parenting figure in Star Trek, because he, you know, he spends time with his kids, he is, you know, obviously cares about them a lot, he doesn't, you know, and he Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. But anyway, he... Okay, I'm completely out of it today. I have no idea what I was going to say. Bob, take over. Talk about these people. I just had the thought. I was just like, and then my thought continues in some manner.
I like the Keiko O'Brien dynamic a lot, because it is very much what I think a normal real couple would be going through with a lot of things that they have to go through, and they have children that they have to take care of at the same time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty evident that, you know, this is a family unit that has family values, right? All the way from when, you know, they first got married and, you know, talking about, you know, sharing their food, their kind of favorite foods together, and then to when Molly is born, you know, the few instances we see where O'Brien does like loves spending time with his children after he comes from home from a long day at work, which, as we know, the Bajoran time scale is actually 26 hours in a day, so I think he might have a longer shift than 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just, I think, wonderful to see that particular family idea has persisted through the 24th century despite all of the, you know, the very much scaled up issues that they have to deal with in a number of episodes through TNG and DS9, including a war where they're on the front lines. And then it's even much more painful when O'Brien has to send Keiko and Molly away.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, because, you know, like, he's got to do his thing here on DS9 and be like, you know, a soldier in a war, you know, and Keiko's not happy about it, like, at all, and that very much affects, you know, Molly as well and his children.
Keiko's never happy about anything.
Well, that's true.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
But as far as parenting goes, I mean, say what you will about Keiko O'Brien, but I think she probably does a good job with, you know, raising the children.
Oh, yeah, she's great to her kids. She's just terrible to Miles for reasons that we won't understand. It's like, we would all love to be married to him. You don't appreciate what you have.
Yeah. So, how about Voyager?
Well, we have like 2 minutes left. I have to head out. I don't think we're going to get to the rest of that stuff, which is weird.
Well, there's only one thing we need to talk about. Well, actually, well, let's think, I guess there's maybe two. We have, well, maybe,
well,
three.
The only literal parent-child relationship in Voyager is Samantha Wildman and Naomi Wildman, and Samantha Wildman is the invisible mom. Like, she's just never around because they don't ever hire her guest star. So she's just not there. I don't know what she's doing, but Naomi Wildman, you know, bored because there's nothing to do on the ship, and I imagine her mom is probably, you know, on duty a lot, is just seen wandering around a lot and interacts with Neelix, who I would never let near my kids, and Seven of Nine, who, interestingly enough, I would also not let near my kids because sometimes she freaks out and does bad things.
Well, here's the thing I want to mention, actually, regarding Seven of Nine, is that she actually takes on a mother role with all the,
the
adolescent Borg drones that come on board.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That is a thing.
Which is very awkward. And she has to, I mean, the whole process is very kind of rushed because she regiments their day very strictly. Like, this hour you are doing this. This next hour you're going to be doing this. Excuse me. And it is pretty much an episode on, you know, parenting is what it is, in Voyager, nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And I think the rest of the crew is pretty much saying, like, Seven, this isn't a healthy way to be raising children. You know, they need more spontaneity in their life, a little more fun. I think it actually goes along to where she actually just schedules an hour for fun, is what happens, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, there are actually a number of other examples of, like, parenting and family relationships in Star Trek that I don't think we're going to get a chance to get to today, but...
No.
Alas.
You know, we can talk about a little bit more next week, since we don't have a whole lot more to get through, but... Next week, instead of wasting a bunch of time talking about George Lucas selling Star Wars, we can talk about the rest of our topic.
Sounds like a plan to me. Oh, so where are you going? You seeing a movie?
No, I have to get ready to record the Tales from the DMZ.
Oh, right, DMZ. That's right.
Yeah, that's all right.
fine, go do that thing that you're going to do with the stuff and put it on the website and make people.
Also, my ears really, really hurt because I've actually been wearing my microphone instead of just putting it on the desk because our levels were all weird. And for some reason, this mic really hurts my ears. Like, this headset.
Yeah. God forbid that you are a normal person put the headphones on your head.
I need to take this thing off. It really hurts.
All the complaints you could ever want. All right, so thank you, folks, for joining us this week on All Things Trek. We'll be back next week, where we'll be finishing up our stuff about family parenting stuff. Yeah. I see Ishka and Quark and Rom are to come.
Yep.
Anyway, everyone have a good night.